Hello, and welcome to Social Design Insights, the weekly podcast that brings you the leading voices of the social design movement from the fields of architecture, engineering, planning, art, and whoever else we can find that's out there trying to make the world a better place. I'm your host, Eric Kessel. Emiliano Gandolfi will be back with us in a couple of weeks, but he's currently ensconced on a remote Mediterranean island working on a top-secret project. We'll let him tell you about that when he gets back. We're kicking off a new year, and there'll be many twists and turns. We promise the same great content and a whole new slate of inspiring voices who are going to tell you their stories about how they change the world around them in ways large and small. Joining us this week is John Carey. John describes himself as a connector, writer, speaker, and curator focused on social change, with an emphasis on design and philanthropy. He's also a 20-year veteran of the social design movement and has been instigating change in a plethora of ways since he was a student. John frequently curates and hosts events for TED, the Aspen Institute, and other entities. He's a philanthropic advisor to foundations and nonprofits around the world, and is also the co-founder of Fresh Speakers, Inc., a next-generation speakers bureau focused on diversifying thought leadership. He's here today to give us a state of the union on the social design movement and some insights into where it needs to go and how designers can design resistance. John, thanks so much for joining us on the show and helping us kick off the year and helping us kick off the segment. We've wanted to get you on the show for a long time and introduce you to our audiences and the work that you do and all the amazing dimensions of it. And I thought a good place to start would be, you know, your origin story. Was this something that really started in your student days? I mean, what was your kind of first brush with the intersection between social impact and design?
Thanks, Eric. You know, it's something that I've continued to process in my own mind, like how in the world did I end up doing some of these things. I cannot say at all that it was a deliberate path or choice. It was very much kind of one thing leading to another. If there's any kind of thread through it, it was simply me looking for things that either needed to be fixed in my assessment or problems that I thought that either I or people that I could gather together could solve. But beyond that, it was more like stumbling in the dark, to be completely honest with you. I mean, I'm the product of a 40-year registered nurse, somebody deeply committed to service through healthcare, as well as a 40-plus-year nonprofit director. So the type of commitment to serving others is definitely something that is in my DNA from them. Coupling it with design is not something that any of my relatives or anyone that I had exposure to growing up ever did, but it has always felt really natural to me. I mean, I'm a very particular person, and others might use different adjectives to describe how that manifests in our working relationship or personal relationships, but being particular and very precise about things was how design manifested in the type of work that I've done in my career and that I continue to do.
So these were really values that you carried with you, like into architecture and design. When did you start getting interested in that?
Well, I grew up in a house initially on the south side of Milwaukee in a very working class area, and then ultimately from kind of the middle of my elementary school on in a suburb north of Milwaukee. You know, obviously a beautiful place, but one that was extremely homogenous, planned without basic things like sidewalks, for example, you know, very car oriented, very isolated. And yet I was in this house with five other siblings. So there were six children total. And I was always searching for private space, like literally quiet space to think. I think became most interested in design and kind of spaces that we inhabit in that search that I was making myself for those quiet moments. And then, of course, there were other experiences that I had, a drafting class in high school, exposure to some courses that piqued my interest once I got to college, et cetera. But there wasn't any other kind of external design introduction that I at least can point to. Most of that came subsequent to me entering or at least deciding to go into architecture as a major.
The earliest kind of advocacy on your part that I remember is your work with AIAS, American Institute of Architecture students. Was that what sort of kicked off this career of change?
It may have been. Predating that just a tiny bit, I had a kind of crash course in kind of writing and communications when I started getting really frustrated with the College of Design, as it's now called, at the University of Minnesota, and how they were communicating with students. There were these thin slot mailboxes where all these Xeroxed newsletters with really important information, ranging from like scholarship opportunities and lectures to other social engagements and that kind of thing, where they would be stuck in there and never read by the students. And so as a result, student life was, I think, very compromised at that college at that time. They were also really poorly written and edited. So I literally would like take a red pencil at my studio desk and I would edit them and I would send them back to the department. And that is indicative of some of my lack of diplomacy around stuff like this. But it also got me a meeting with the dean, this guy named Tom Fisher, who obviously I now know was the longtime editor of Progressive Architecture Magazine, is a huge voice in the profession. And he said, listen, people don't appreciate when you do this. And I apologized. He said, but I think you're onto something here. If you can figure out a way to better communicate with your peers, I'll support you to do that. And so he ultimately gave me a corner office. It was an emeritus faculty member, but nonetheless, he gave me their office, a computer, a telephone, and I started collecting email addresses and then emailing, you know, upwards of 1,000 students every single week, and created at least some greater communications channels. And that type of organizing, really basic stuff, led me to the AIAS. I was suddenly kind of one of the voices of the college. That got me elected to be the chapter president of AIAS. That then got me elected to be the national vice president of the AIAS. But the most, I think, formative thing for me was not through one of those structured environments like school or through AIS. It was, in fact, looking at the very unstructured world of internship and, you know, the kind of experiences of young architects as they progressed toward licensure, that I ended up creating a nonprofit organization called Arc Voices that tried to research, document the experiences of interns and young architects, and then do a great deal of advocacy on their behalf. And of course, at that point, I was an intern myself. And so it wasn't like I was just speaking for other people. I was also speaking for the experience that I both wanted, and at least at that time, felt like I needed.
How do you see the profession having evolved from this kind of early work as a student marking up administration documentation? You've really been sort of along the course of the 20-year evolution of public interest design. What's different today than it was 20 years ago?
In terms of the architecture profession generally, before I get into the type of design that you know I care so much about, I see glacial progress relative to the profession. The challenges that at this point are very well documented, you know, there've been dozens of events around them, specifically in the internship and licensure arena, but other areas as well. The structures and the systems that our profession relies on to train and to ultimately credential the next generation of architects needs to be dramatically reformed. It is very restrictive. That manifests in a very, very homogenous group of people that make it through that process. And yet, of course, there are really amazing people who do not subscribe to that process, who are doing extremely important work in the world. Today, we see some of the best practices relative to the kind of what, you know, I have historically called public interest design, and others have used that term, but what I would also brand more generally these days as just design for the public good, we see those practices being led by people who are not licensed. And in fact, in most of the locales where they are working, they themselves do not need to be licensed, but the people who, of course, are the architects of record or whatever it might be in those environments, ultimately, we hope, would be licensed. But beyond the profession itself, I've seen the kind of cadre of practitioners and the types of projects they are producing changed dramatically from where we were even a decade ago.
We've seen other sort of evidence of that trend, right? I mean, we see kind of social impact designers winning Pritzker Awards all of a sudden, and it's like the exclusivity that might have existed 10 years ago, a project's either got to be for good or it's got to be good design, is collapsing, is the trend that you see.
That's exactly what I see. And I think that that is only a good thing. You know, there's risks, of course, but by and large, that is only a very positive and long-awaited thing.
What do you think about, I mean, as social design has become sort of a more popular practice area and people kind of start to go into it, how do we hold ourselves accountable for what is actually impactful design? What is actually good design? What is actually helping people in the way that architects often claim that their projects are helping people?
Well, I think the next frontier of this type of work is a culture of constructive criticism that moves beyond the kind of parade of projects or the cheerleading that I've certainly participated in and led at different points. And I think that if you look at how movements are built or how fields are built, there is a time and a place for just kind of general broad scale promotion of projects that embody the values of whatever that movement is seen to be. But the challenge is that so much of the dialogue and the discourse around these projects remains solely from the vantage point of designers' intentions. Rarely do we hear from the clients or especially the users who are most directly impacted by that work. And as one of the people that has probably invested the most time and certainly writing in the spirit of that goal to make the voices of clients and users more widely heard, I know probably better than anyone how challenging it is, how difficult it is, how anecdotal it is in many ways. And yet those are the stories that I still believe are the most powerful when it comes to articulating the dignifying power of design, but also the ones that seem to resonate with people beyond the choir, beyond the people who already believe in design. And so I think we need many, many more stories like them. And I really look to those people as the true design ambassadors that we've yet to cultivate.
And you've recently collected a lot of these stories into a new book, Design for Good, A New Era of Architecture for Everyone. And for our listeners, we'll link to it on our website. It's an amazing book and does what John just described. I mean, it's a book of storytelling from the vantage point of the people who actually use buildings, and I think represents a departure from a more typical standardized form of architectural narrative where we just sort of hear what the architect thinks about their own project and what they think it does, and the other voices are silenced or never listened to in the first place. So John, maybe you could tell us, why this book? Why now? Does this represent a sort of pivotal point in your evolution as an individual or the evolution of the field?
This was the book that I needed to read. And so it was a book that I didn't see out there in the landscape of publications. And it was really born at a time that I know you are very familiar with, Eric, with the collapse of Architecture for Humanity and a lot of people, both in the media and in the profession, asking, is this the end of public interest design? It was a legitimate question because it was the foremost leader of this work that would no longer exist in its original form. And yet I looked out at the field and I saw groups like Orchid Studio, Mass Design Group, as well as mainstream practices that had a very clear, well-defined social good component like Studio Gang and even some larger firms. And I wanted to understand, well, how did they think about their work? What was the impact that they were having? How have these projects that have been completed in the last 5 years proven to be different or in some cases better than, and in other cases not as successful as, the past work that we had held up so highly? I wanted from the get-go to write this book not just for designers, but for people from all sectors and all walks of life that could benefit from having their expectations of design raised. I wanted to do that by documenting and sharing these stories of actual building clients and users and how their lives or their work or their organizations have been transformed, changed, or obviously, hopefully, benefited from design.
You're listening to Social Design Insights. We hope you've been enjoying these thoughts from John Carey, but we're going to take a quick break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with more Social Design Insights after the break. Welcome back to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel. We've been speaking with John Carey about the history and origins of the social design movement. Coming up, we're going to talk about more tactical forms of resistance and John's thoughts about where the professions of design should stand. Let's listen. Could you share with our listeners a little bit about, you know, how you began to approach this as a project? I mean, was it just going to these projects and sitting down with people who occupy them and saying, hey, what do you think about this architecture? I mean, what's the beginning point?
From proposal to my publisher until the what we call the publication date, the date the book that came out, it was almost exactly 2 years, just to give you a timeline. I spent months, literally, before putting any pen to paper, just conceptualizing the projects in my head. That's also before I started really talking to anyone, aside from, you know, a few peers or others that helped me structure it. I then spent a great deal of time researching projects, mainly through the web, but I have visited a great many of the projects in the book as well. So all of the projects that are in Rwanda are ones that I've visited. Projects elsewhere in Africa I visit as well, and then a lot of the projects here in the U.S., including one that's like a couple miles from my house in Oakland, California, I had a chance to visit, sometimes multiple times. And I decided to structure it with these like longer, what we call long read essays. So these are minimally about 2,500 words all the way up to about 6,500 words. And when you get to that upper threshold, that's kind of the length of a New Yorker article that you might read. Not that I'm comparing the quality of my writing to any New Yorker writing, but nonetheless, that's the length. And I'll be honest with you, I was terrified making those first phone calls and doing those interviews. I was nervous. I had a whole lot of imposter syndrome, being like, who am I to call up so-and-so and take some of their valuable time and ask them about this? Or am I just replicating by getting on the phone first with the designers that I was most comfortable with? Am I just like doing what I've been critiquing all along? And that's just documenting designers' good intentions. And so I had to really work through a lot of the kind of emotions around this. And yet after every single interview, my wife can attest, I would say to her, sometimes teary-eyed, because they were that moving and sometimes emotionally draining for me, I would say to her, that's the best interview that I've ever experienced. And it's true, because I was hearing things that we do not hear in design discourse. We do not hear it. We may, every once in a while, at a project opening or some other venue, we may hear from a client or user that thanks designers for their work. But we are generally not sitting in the one-bedroom apartment of a guy that was homeless for 5 years in the streets of Oakland, sitting with him as he points around his apartment, talking about all the things that he appreciates about it because of the experience that he had living on the street for 5 years. We are not in that position. And yet I've certainly, you know, my design expectations, both for the work, the type of practices, the kind of financing is accessible for these types of projects, it has skyrocketed since I talked to these people, because I really began to understand what is at stake. And that is something that I hope finds its way into the pages of the book.
Thank you for that. I mean, I think that what resonates out of that is, you know, the power of dialogue between designers and the world. And for too long, we've really been sort of this insular body that, you know, we kind of talk to each other and we talk to critics and, you know, look at magazines and stuff like that. And it's so bad that it's actually become somewhat revolutionary to go out and have the sort of conversations that you're discussing. Just to bring it back full circle, how much of that do you think we can kind of trace back to schooling and the way that architects are educated, the sort of insularity of the dialogue, the sort of hesitation or nervousness or unwillingness to go out and actually talk to normal people in normal language about, hey, like, this is a building, this is what it can do, this is your building, how can we make it better, that sort of thing. Is it fair to blame schooling?
Schools are very easy to point to because there is a quantifiable number of them, roughly 120 accredited architecture programs in the United States, and obviously many more programs around the world. But they get a lot of attention because it is much more difficult to point to this huge spectrum of firms that in fact are the ones doing this actual work. granted, it's based on the training that students receive or graduates have received in school. But I, for one, don't believe that the silver bullet is changing architectural education. I think that there is change that can be made. And I think there is still room for a school, any school, a single school, to put a stake in the ground and say, everything that we do is about the public good. And this is how we are going to achieve that, meaning interacting with real people and actual communities as the kind of core foundation of that type of approach. But still, beyond school, I do feel like there are many other avenues for the profession to be much more inclusive, less isolated, and ultimately much more diverse in its approach. And so I think a lot about that from a structural standpoint of how architectural practice goes on today here in the U.S. and around the world.
Well, that's optimistic. I mean, at least means that we've got a lot of room to run and we've got some momentum. So optimism is always welcome on this show, and you're always welcome back. One final question, perhaps. We wanted you here to help kick off the year because it is the original Social Design Insights program was kind of conceived as, it's been 10 years. How do we reflect on, you know, where the social design movement is at and what's been accomplished and where we need to go? And of course, you know, we've interviewed dozens of people in the past year and asking that question. We're also kicking off this segment, Can We Design Resistance? I found myself after the last election and simultaneous events like Brexit and sort of thing, asking myself questions about, you know, how do we change? How do we evolve? Does social design practice need to be something different than what it is in order to respond to these sorts of changes in the world? I spent all last year asking people about it, and the response was usually no. You know, most practitioners came back with an opinion that, you know, their work was ongoing. It was stable, and they were all dealing with the same problems. And Rick Lowe famously said, you know, my community has had the same problems under Trump that it had under Obama, that it had under George W. Bush. And, you know, our work continues and will continue until the problem is solved and the community is served. But I wanted to get your opinion, and I wanted to ask about it. Do all of these sort of changes change the way that you think social design should be practiced? Is there some sort of modification in our methodology or thinking or the way that different groups work together or the way that groups get their funding that we need to be on the lookout for?
Well, I generally trust the wisdom of Rick Lowe, you know, as we all should. I have a slightly different angle on it. And I guess that the one thing that the past election, major election that took place in 2016 did for me, and that I know it's done for other people, perhaps not in design circles, is that it has woken us up. It has hopefully shattered any type of complacency, and it's shown us what is at risk when we actually feel like we've got it all figured out, or that our process is working perfectly, or that we are serving the people that we think we are to some degree. The reality, at least if you talk to voters across the political spectrum, is that people feel left behind or left out. I don't always agree with their decision making about how they go about rectifying that, who they turn to when they are looking to be heard or seen. But we now know what is at stake. And yet there are some very specific things that architecture, design, and, you know, the construction industry more broadly have done to participate complicitly in this administration's work to marginalize people. And there are literally full-scale mock-ups of a wall that this government, with a lot of fanfare and a lot of support from Trump's base, is planning to erect along the border of two adjacent countries. And I don't think we can ever, ever underestimate the message that that sends to build something. We know how powerful the built environment can be, that it literally shapes us and our ideas about who we are in the world and what we deserve. And we are watching a wall be built. It is also a wall that is going to be easily climbed and overcome. So it is simply a folly. But the resources that are going into that are being diverted from other, you know, even basic infrastructure. But imagine other places beyond the kind of the most fundamental infrastructure to think about, like our decaying schools, for example, or our completely inhumane prisons, or any number of other places that could benefit from the design and engineering expertise that is being poured into those walls. And I don't think that any ethical profession that is overseen by a group that claims to have a code of ethics and professional conduct, the American Institute of Architects, can or should be participating in those types of exercises, no matter who came calling and asking for them, no matter who needs the money that is trickling down or is in pursuit of the money that's trickling down from the federal government. I feel like it is time that architects and designers put a stake in the ground that we will not participate in this type of work. And yet I hear a whole lot of silence around exactly that project and other ones that this administration had been advocating for.
Well, let's try and change that. I'm hereby encouraging all of our listeners to go out and make some noise, because I think you're absolutely right. You know, some of these projects and our values as design professions are fundamentally irreconcilable. Yeah, so thank you for that. And thank you for your time, John, and the inspiration and being willing to come on the show and talk to our listeners about this wonderful time that we live in and the opportunities and the challenges ahead.
You bet, Eric. Always my pleasure to speak with you. And I love the work that the Curry Stone Foundation has done historically. I've been a part of the jury in the past for the prize. I think this new iteration of it based around these conversations is really invaluable, and I think it can be truly transformative for the people listening.
You've been listening to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel. I'd like to thank my guest of the week, John Carey, for his insights into the social design movement, its origins, and its future. Next week, we're going to be speaking more about this border wall conundrum with Professor Ronald Rael as we continue to consider the interplay between design and resistance. We hope that you'll tune in for that. We'll link to John's new book on our website at socialdesigninsights.com. There, you'll also find some further links about John's work, his writing, and his perspectives on resistance and social impact design. Social Design Insights is an initiative of the Curry Stone Design Prize and the Curry Stone Foundation. If you haven't already, please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter for all the latest news on social impact design.